The Ryan Tubridy Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Sky Broadband. With our broadband, your world is limitless. Live beyond.
But I want to welcome to the studio Ardal O'Hanlon. Good morning, Ardal. Good morning, Ryan. It's been a while since I saw you, actually, but thank you for coming in to see us this morning.
It's lovely. Lovely to be here.
We've much to discuss, largely because you've been kind of road testing, it seems like, a comedy tour. Is that right?
Yeah.
You cast a fly. Is that it, to see what's going?
Yeah. I did a leg of this tour in the spring,
yes,
in the UK mostly. So I was parked there for a while. Trolling our British neighbours, essentially.
Is that what you were doing?
Well, there's a touch of that. You know, I mean, I try to avoid like hard politics in my show. Like, I'm very politically engaged in some ways. You know, I'm interested in politics. But I try to avoid it in my show because, you know, I've misgivings about comedians like wearing their politics or their ideology on their sleeve. You know, I think your primary role as a comedian is to poke fun at everybody and everything. And, you know, to stand back like a corner boy in the old days, you know, sneering at everyone. So, you know, I find comedians who are a little bit too ideological, you know, just a bit po-faced.
Yes, yeah, and a little earnest, and with that, quite dull. Yeah.
But having said that, you have to touch on things like Brexit when you're there, you know. And you have to find a way of doing it. Like, I play to a very mixed audience when I'm over there. You know, I don't play it like, you know, I'm not playing to the gallery, you know, to my sort of liberal constituency, you know. Yeah. I'm playing to a very mixed crowd. A lot of older people, sometimes younger people, certainly a lot of Brexiteers, you know, I'm playing, you know, it's half and half. So you have to find a way of navigating all that.
That's intriguing because the vote was, what, 52-48 in the referendum for Brexit. And conversations in America, I mean, I'm talking about like a polite conversation, whether it's in a coffee shop or at dinner with friends. You don't know who you're talking to now, because if the privacy of the ballot box is just that, so you have to. As a comedian, like, in your audience, you don't know who. Where.
It's like, it's in America. So, you know, it is like you know, Americans, as we know, are the most friendly, polite, hospitable people in the world until you start talking to them.
More recently, yes.
Yeah, and it's so divided and so dysfunctional.
Yes. But does that fall on both sides in terms of, you know, the political discourse has got quite dark. If you think about the Trump rallies and, you know, his attitude, say, to the press and so forth. And this isn't, I'm not trying to basket of deplorable this conversation about the Trump supporters. There's nothing to do with that. I can, you know, that's not it. Really, it's more just about the tenor of debate.
Yeah. I mean, I think Trump, like, one of his great achievements, and he's achieved an awful lot, as he'll tell you every day, one of his best achievements is absolutely coarsening political debate and driving it right down into the gutter. You know, it's the complete lack of civility now in politics. It's the shameless, barefaced lying. I love that Washington Post project.
Where they
count the lies, you know, and they call them out for what they are. They're lies, verifiable lies. I think it's over 10,000 now, you know. And like, I used to do a joke in my show, I couldn't be bothered doing it anymore. It's about, like, Trump is such a big liar, like the biggest liar in the world. If he came out tomorrow and admitted he was a lying, racist, misogynist, I don't think I'd believe him, you know. And that's where my head's at most days.
And that's kind of crisscrossed across the Atlantic and over the Irish Sea and into 10 Downing Street. And as per the Channel 4 boss there, we played her earlier on, saying it's no longer acceptable to kind of make excuses for or to offer a nuance to a misspeaking and just call it for what it is.
There is no justification for Boris Johnson. I mean, did you see him on the news last night?
Yeah.
He just looked like the naughty schoolboy who had forgotten to do his homework, and he's just winging it. I remember a brilliant line by Guardian journalist Marina Hyde, who's, you know, frequently hilarious about all these things, and she described him as like a rubbish bag opened by a fox. And that's what I think about every time I see him. That's who he is.
But is he not beloved of a massive section of the British public? I mean, you're not a British citizen. I'm not a British citizen. Who are we to say, other than as couch-bound observers of the news? You know, and what business is it of ours? But that's one question. And the second thing is, you know, there are people who think he's the bee's knees and he's a wonderful...
Yeah, I mean, he's a good raconteur. He's
gas,
a character.
Yeah.
He's a gas man. But, you know, like, I think... You know, you'd prefer to have serious people you know, running countries.
Well, that's a very old-fashioned trope now.
I'm an old-fashioned guy.
But listen to Brazil. And yeah. The guy is saying that the NGOs, the president, set the fires.
Yeah.
It's like Alice in Wonderland.
But it's the disregard. It's like, who cares about the fires? You know, it's a very strange world we live in. I mean, I think the big problem is, you know, we all take it too seriously and too personally ourselves in some senses. You know, like, I don't know about you, but I wake up in the morning, first thing I do would be, you know, grab my phone or stick on Morning Ireland. And, you know, so for the first hour of your day, you're listening to the latest Trump outburst or the latest Brexit nonsense or the crazy man in Brazil and the fires.
Yeah.
And this is before you've spoken a civil word to anyone else, before you've hugged anyone, before you've listened to Kate Bush, before you've had your toast, before you've stroked the dog, you know.
Yeah.
And you're starting every day appalled and outraged.
Yeah,
it's not healthy, Ryan.
It's not healthy.
And you're talking about it now. We could be talking about anything but pleasant, and you know.
But it's just, I think it's so consuming. Even if you watch kids watching the news, they're kind of freaked out.
Yeah.
You know, going, well, I don't know if I want, why is the fire, is the world ending? Why are there two yellow-haired men running the world? I don't understand.
People are,
you know, free.
There's a malaise.
And yet, having said that, this is two people probably of a similar hue chatting to each other, and then there'll be people who'll be listening in going, you guys are so wrong. You've got it so wrong, you know, that actually Trump is speaking for an enormous amount of people, that the Boris Johnson is speaking an awful lot of sense. You know, that's back to the divisions we spoke about.
Well, I agree with you. And I kind of pine for... you know, the middle ground. I miss it. I miss nuance. I miss, you know, people having moderate opinions. That was always great. But and now, you know, you are forced to choose. You're forced to pick your tribe. Like, you know, they used to talk about the culture wars, and you know, that was kind of vague, like, you know, the culture wars. But now it's a real thing. We had it in Ireland during the various referendums to some extent. Britain had it with Brexit, America had it with Trump, you know, where suddenly now there is this division. And you look at, like, say Britain, you know, where I spend a fair bit of time, you've got propaganda organs like The Guardian and The Telegraph. Yeah. They're no longer objective newspapers.
Yeah, they're Fox and CNN, you know.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. And you sort of have to pick, you know, so, you know, I lean towards The Guardian because, you know, I you know, see myself as a vaguely wishy-washy liberal type person. But, you know, I can't read it anymore. Like, it's extreme. Yeah, but it's almost a parody of itself. And likewise, The Telegraph on the other side is just ridiculous, you know, just, you know, promoting these opposing ideologies.
Yeah.
And you know, you kind of just miss, like, you know, where's objectivity? You know, where's...
Well, you know, I think that, unless that's a rhetorical question, in which case I'll shut up, but otherwise I think that you have to look closer to home. I think we in this country are doing rather well as...
It's fantastic to be on the high moral ground, isn't it?
It's took us years. But, you know, when you think of, you know, even the leadership politically on both, on all sides, it seems to be quite mature and constructive. And, you know, even the, you know, the fact that Taoiseach is a gay man who is, in, you know, 40 years old and, you know, represents us well abroad and home. You know, there's a lot of, there's a lot to be taken from how we are doing in the face of all the crazy next door.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. Yeah. And, you know, we are holding the middle ground. We seem to be one of the few societies who are managing to do that.
Yeah,
and there's no shame in that.
No.
But people want drama in their lives. Like, this is the thing.
Well, they got it.
Yeah, well, just get a smoke machine for your house and, you know, just give it a few blasts in the morning and put on some Beethoven and that'll give you all the drama you need.
Calm. That's why God created Lyric FM, I think, just to calm us all down. Your father was, he was a politician, he was a minister. And he was, you know, he was a teetotaler, unusual enough, I suppose, for his time. Yeah. What do you?
I made up for that.
Well, you made up for that as a youngster. How do you reflect on him now, just politically, and what he left you legacy wise?
I don't know. I mean, I always admired him. I admired his work ethic was the big thing when I was growing up. I couldn't understand it, why someone would want to pound the pavements like hour after hour, day after day, week in, week out, year in, year out. I mean, he was an incredibly hardworking rural Irish politician, you know, who left no stone unturned, wanted to help people, loved his country more than anything else, still does, you know. So he's an absolute patriot to the core of his being, in the best possible sense of the word, I think. And, you know, worked very hard. In terms of, like, the politics, as I grew older, like when I was a kid, like when he got elected first, it was just very exciting. You know, elections were really exciting in those days.
Posters and leaflets.
Yeah,
and it was just ballot papers and pencils.
Yeah, yeah, and you know, it was the back of trucks in the town, and there was crowds used to come to listen to politicians speaking on the back of trucks things, and after mass and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, there was a tremendous excitement, and you know, that your father was involved in this was, it was a cool thing, I suppose. But then as I went to college and you know, my head was turned, and you know, you get involved in politics, and you end up sort of signing you know, those kind of things, like
But he was obviously Fianna Fáil, I should stress that as well. When you said your head was turned, was that politically?
Yeah, kind of politically, I suppose, like particularly on the social issues of the day. So you had divorce referendums, you had
abortion
referendums, and all those kind of things, and you know, you know, I just, you know, sort of diverged, I suppose, fairly, you know, radically, in terms of political views from my father. You know,
Did that cause a problem?
Well, I mean, my family are very conservative people. I mean, they're lovely people, and I get on well with them. I'm glad to say that we're able to do that, you know, despite the very heated debates over the last couple of years. So we're still very, very civil to each other, and we kind of sometimes sidestep some of those bigger issues when we meet. But I did. I went to England. I scarpered, like, you know, fairly soon after I started comedy. Well, because it was uncomfortable for him, it was uncomfortable for me. It would have been very uncomfortable for a government minister at the time to have a son who was a stand-up comedian, like, shooting his mouth off and just being really incredibly stupid about a lot of things. And then it would have been really awkward for me trying to have credibility as a comedian living in somewhere like in a small society like Dublin, you know, where people would pick up on that and maybe make sport out of it, you know. And anyway, you know, there was no comedy scene in Ireland. So, like, you know, I was always going to go to London to try and, you know, find my way as a comedian.
Yes.
But it was a relief to get away. Do you know what I mean? And and not to have that constant association
with the politician father and the comedian.
And it's not that I'm anti Fianna Fáil or anything like that. You know, certainly not. You know, I you know, they always kind of steered a kind of a middle course. You know, in the Bertie Ahern's three terms as Taoiseach, you know, like up to the last couple of years.
Up to the cliff edge fall.
It seemed to work okay.
Yeah.
You know, not for everyone, of course, but, you know.
And when you talk about the conservative family then, when you were a child, were you a show-off? I mean,
well,
and how did that
not
work
really. I call my show The Showing Off Must Go On.
That's like, what I'm wondering.
Like, well, you see, my family were very, like, as I said, hardworking people, but also head down people. You know, you don't stick your head above the parapet.
Don't be noticed.
Don't be noticed at all. Like, it's like even I come from Carrick and Cross. People don't wear high vis jackets in Carrick and Cross in case people think they're showing off. Look at them there holding the stop go sign, the big show off, wants everyone to look at them. You know, I actually literally remember one time my mother made spaghetti bolognese for the family. And she told us, don't tell anyone, in case the neighbours thought we were showing off. You know, oh, they hear the Hanlons have gone all Italian, you know, next they'll be throwing tomatoes at each other and showing affection in public, you know, and painting frescoes on the ceilings of churches. Like, so, like, that was the kind of...
So it was like, head down...
Head down, but don't show off. You get new clothes, don't wear them.
Like, they're probably still in the drawer at home.
They're still there at home. I go and look at them from time to time. But, like... You know, so it was that kind of family. Like, it was.
But your auntie Maura, your aunt Maura.
Oh yes, I had an aunt Maura. Yes.
Did she not come to you and say, "Tell us another story, or make me laugh"? Or
oh yeah,
was she sort of a catalyst for the
beginning? Yeah, I mean, I was a quite shy kid, but I suppose not in the context of the big family that I came from. There were six of us, and I suppose maybe I was the show off in the context of the family.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean? In the house, and
of course.
You know, I do remember my aunt Maura coming and. She seemed to always enjoy my stories and my made-up stories, like about my imaginary friend.
Did they have a name, or was that just a random, your imaginary
Eamon.
Friend?
Eamon was his name.
Right, straight off the tongue.
You have no idea when I heard that Eamon wasn't real, like how devastated I was.
Who told you?
My brother, Frank.
Did he exist?
No.
It's getting a bit surreal. But it was a difficult time for you, obviously.
It was a difficult time. But then, you know, I finally found an outlet for my stories.
You did. You found the stage. Your grandfather was Michael O'Hanlon. His association with Michael Collins, because we started our show on Monday in Skull talking to Michael Collins' great-grandniece.
Oh, wow.
We end our week talking to Ardal O'Hanlon about, among other things, your grandfather, Michael O'Hanlon.
Yeah.
And his connection with Collins.
He was an extraordinary man. I didn't really know him well, but he was... He was one of the hand-picked men that Michael Collins sent out after Bloody Sunday. And my history is terrible, by the way, if I recall the memories. Yeah. 1919?
It would have been... Well, go on anyway.
Michael Collins had this mission, which was featured in the movie Michael Collins as well, of course, and in all good history books, where, you know, the rebels at the time were tasked with taking out British intelligence in Ireland. So there was 12 three-man hit squads sent around various parts of Dublin. And he was part of that outfit. You know, he was just 18 at the time. He was a medical student in UCD, but he was a very committed rebel, fought in the War of Independence, was sentenced to death. You know, by General Mulcahy, as so many of the people who fell on the wrong side of the Civil War. This is slightly later after the Civil War.
Yes,
that death sentence was later commuted. He had an amazing life, but he was a very quiet man. Never spoke about it. I shouldn't be talking about it now, probably.
Well, no, I suppose it's intriguing that he would have been led by Collins, and then his son, your father, became a Fianna Fáil minister, which mm-hmm. would have been very much Dev and anti-treaty.
Yeah.
I wonder what happened and what got lost in translation or found in translation along the way there.
Yeah.
But and then we get into the Irish independence and finding our feet quite well. And all roads then bring us to kind of Brexit in a way and how they seem to be falling apart at the seams and their parliament is a mess.
Yeah.
Leadership.
Well, they seem to be
messy.
Going through an identity crisis.
Don't
you
they?
Know, like in the early part of the 20th century, Ireland went through a massive identity crisis. We reinvented ourselves. We created an identity in a sense with our new sports and our, you know, our music and our dancing and our costumes and reviving the Irish language and all these things. You know, we're a big part of an identity creating exercise. And
sure.
I think the British or the English, I suppose, really to be more precise about it, are going through a similar identity crisis at the moment.
Yeah, and happens. It's cyclical, isn't it?
It's cyclical and it's convulsive and it's going to have massive ramifications. And by the way, they're fully entitled to.
Yeah.
Absolutely. It's just the way they're handling it is shocking.
Yeah.
And they seem to, like, at every step, you know, make the worst possible decision. Putting Boris Johnson in there is a good example of that.
Yes, and Jeremy Corbyn's another day's work.
So what we want to happen is, to be positive, just... for the sake of it, is, you know, we want a general election. We'd love to see a Labour Lib Dem coalition without Jeremy Corbyn at the helm, and then have another referendum.
This is the Guardian Easter dream,
is
it?
Yeah, this is the dream.
Okay, and you're living in the UK now, right?
No, I live in Dublin.
Oh, did you? I thought you were over there.
No. I did the first half of the tour over there, and then I was away for the summer filming this other thing, and then I'm back now to do the second half of the tour, which includes a big Irish leg.
Oh, wonderful! So, Death in Paradise is where, like, if you look at your the big TV moments with Father Ted and Death in Paradise, obviously completely different things. How do you reflect on the two shows now?
Well, they're both set on islands.
That's a good start. but they brought very different things to your world.
Yeah, definitely very different things. And that's the beauty of this career in one way. You know, there's a lot of uncertainty in a career like mine. And, you know, you go through ups and downs and good times, bad times. But Death in Paradise, it was one of those weird jobs that came out of nowhere about 4 years ago. I've spent the last four summers in this island called Guadeloupe in the middle of the Caribbean.
Yeah.
Sounds amazing, but it's hard work, and you know it's an interesting job. It's a good job, you know, and I've got a lot out of it.
But your kids are of an age now where they don't, you know, you know, you don't have to rush back to bottle feed them now. They're out the other side.
No,
a different type of bottle, maybe.
It was actually a show that they really liked
good.
At the time, so it was a very easy decision to make, you know.
So that's good. How old are your...
They're 22, 20 and 17.
They're grand.
Yeah.
They're grand. And when you look at, I mean, I just want to mention briefly your brief role in Derry Girls, which was one of those great comic successes of recent times.
Yeah.
When you watched the first few episodes of it, did you think they're onto something? Did you get it immediately?
Yeah. I knew the writer Lisa McGee anyway, because I'd done her previous show on Channel 4 called London Irish, which wasn't a success. in any way, but, you know, Channel 4 stuck with her.
Yeah, and try again, yeah.
Gave her a second go, and she got the tone absolutely bang on with Derry Girls. It's beautiful, fun. What I love about it is it's just, you know, it crosses all the generations. They're all represented. You know, it's women mostly, women characters, but, you know, it just works so well.
It's a win. It's a win. Yeah. Let's get some texts in with Ardal O'Hanlon this morning. Please ask Ardal to tell the story of the time he got a taxi home from Dublin Airport regarding his car parked there from Paula in Dartry.
Oh, God.
Well, what happened?
Well, it's true, obviously I've struggled to escape, you know, the Dougal character over the years, and a couple of years ago, I remember, like, I was in this taxi, and I arrived at Dublin Airport, and I asked the taxi driver to take me home. Like, I gave him the address. I didn't just assume he knew where I lived or anything. And he just wanted to talk about Father Ted, and he was kind of looking at me with pity. Like, people think I'm genuinely very stupid, you know. And he actually asked me at one point, he said, do you remember being in it? Like, yeah, sort of. Yeah. And so I'm trying to change the subject to sport, politics or whatever, and I'm using big words to try and impress him. And
this is your life, basically.
This is my life, yes, this is my life. And then I suddenly remember, I was about 20 minutes into the journey home, and I did remember that I'd actually have a car and that I parked it at the airport 3 days previously. And, you know, I was tired and I couldn't tell him.
I
literally, you know, because I know how the world works, you know, one little slip up, you never be allowed to forget.
That's
it.
For sure.
You never believe I'm making an Egypt. So I actually let him take me home as soon as I was at home.
For the shame.
I called another taxi and I went back to the airport. So a true story. But
it's a great one. Tom says, ask Ardal, did he enjoy Death in Paradise, which you've answered, which is great. Ardal is a pure tonic, great start to the working day. Well, that's better than being bamboozled by Brexit. I worked in the summer of 1989 with Ardal at the check-in in Aer Lingus.
Oh my God.
He had us all laughing all summer and would barely scrape together the parts of the uniform and was sitting at a desk one day with one epaulette and a different coloured tie than the official black one. Say hi from Gerry Kennedy. So that's a nice memory from your desk days.
Very good. There was a little scene in Father Ted once about, you know, one about very, 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 very black. So, you know, that came from my time at the airport because you had to wear very, 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 very black socks. And my socks were just dark blue. And I got in trouble. I was actually not allowed work at the check-in that desk day because my socks were just very, very, very dark
blue. Zero tolerance, if ever I heard. Last one from Tom, our friend Tom in Rosslare, who says, tell Ardal, as a PC repairman who looked after TD's PCs in the 90s, I could tell his father was really proud of him because every time I powered up his dad's PC, it always had a great photo of Ardal on the desktop.
Oh.
Did you know that?
God, the rest of the family wouldn't be too happy about that.
I know. No. Maybe it was a family photo.
Yeah,
and
I'm sure it was. My father's always been very fair.
Very
and
equitable. Okay. There's a whole other story there we'll get to another day. But in the meantime, you're in Vicar Street in Dublin. Great venue on the 9th of November. And then 20 days later, you're up to Limerick's University Concert Hall.
That's right.
And on the following day, then 30th of November, on Belfast Waterfront.
Yes.
Great to have you back on the touring circuit.
Yes.
And thanks
for
coming.
Cork and Galway as well, I think.
Oh, great. You're covering the whole island. Which
Oh, God, yeah.
It's always great.
Wouldn't leave the Cork people out.
No, you wouldn't. You wouldn't want to darken a door there again after that. Ardal O'Hanlon, what a pleasure to see you, as always.
Thanks, Ryan.
Thanks for your time this morning.
All right,
it's 10 to 10.